From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the American birth rate, which is tanking. Women are having fewer children, and more couples just aren't having them at all. They're worried about the environment, worried about the economy. They have debt and doubts. So we're going to talk about what low fertility means. Is it good or bad? And what does it tell us about the future of American families? We'll be right back.
Benjamin Franklin said, "Tell me and I forget. Teach me and I may remember. Involve me and I learn." That sums up KUER's community calendar pretty well. You'll learn new things, like how to make your own honey, or write a story, or arrange flowers. There are new events every week, and if you've got something you want to show people, you can post your own events too. Check out the community calendar under the events tab at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The fertility rate is at a record low in this country. Last year, same thing, record low. In fact, there's been a pretty steady decline. Experts say one of the longest declines in years and years. And it's hard to pin down exactly why, though we'll talk about that today. There are a lot of factors to consider. Maybe it's the economy, student debt or rising house prices. Maybe the environment, climate change or sprawl. Our guests today say there's some cultural stuff to think about as well. People are waiting to get married. They're having less sex. They're not procreating because they're anxious about things and they're distracted by technology and pornography. So today in the program, we're talking about the American birth rate. Why is it crashing? And maybe that's too strong a word, but our first guest calls the birth rate drop a hardcore decline. Lyman Stone is an agricultural economist at the USDA and a regional population economics researcher. He blogs about demographics and immigration on his blog. It's called In a State of Migration. Well, let's just start with the numbers. First of all, to this question of whether fertility in the United States is declining, you say, yes, of course it is. But in fact, you say that we're in a hardcore decline. What are you saying? Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of times where fertility rates bounce up and down because it's a bad year, it's a good year. There's a famous case with the Year of the Dragon in China where it was an auspicious year, and so you get much higher birth rates in that year. But what we're seeing now is that the decline in fertility, it's not just young women, it's not just a shift in births later in life. We're seeing declines all the way through women up into their 30s in this most recent data from 2017. So we're seeing a major shift in fertility, not just a 1 or 2 year bump. And it's at a time when the economy is getting better too. And the younger generation is starting to actually buy their own houses and, you know, move into the stage of life where traditionally people really are able to settle down and have kids. But, well, they are settling down. We are settling down, but we're not having kids.
Yeah. We're going to get to the reason why that might be. But one of the things you say is that the story is about, this is how you've described it, disappointed hopes more than, you know, declining fertility. Explain what you mean by that. Mm-hmm. Basically, you're saying people still want kids. It's just that we're not making it easy for them to have them.
Mm-hmm. Right. So there's a lot of surveys about people's childbearing or family size expectations, and they all ask different questions. You know, how many kids do you intend to have, expect to have, desire to have? How many would be ideal? How many would you have in a life do-over? What's your ideal family? You know, we question this a million different ways, which on the one hand is irritating, but on the other hand means that we've thoroughly tested, are people just responding to a fluke of the question? Or are they giving their real desires about their family? And the truth is, no matter how you phrase the question, no matter how you cut it, no matter how you try and sort of steel man the argument, women in America reliably report that they want somewhere between 2.1 and 2.7 children. And that has been true for the last at least 30 years. It's not declining. In fact, it's stable, or in some ways of analyzing it, desired childbearing may even be rising. So we're not seeing an ideological shift away from having kids, and yet fertility is falling. Yeah. So what we are seeing is that the gap between particularly what women desire for themselves, what they expect their life to look like, versus what it actually ends up looking like, it's a shortfall in expectations. It's disappointed hopes. And to me, this is a compelling part of the reason to care about declining fertility, is because people say they want a certain kind of life, and then our society doesn't make it possible to have that life. That is lost welfare. That's people who are, this is a kind of undercurrent of sadness that is settled on a large swath of American families, and particularly on women.
To this idea that I hear all the time, and I know it's completely anecdotal, but it's the idea that young people don't want to bring kids into – it seems like we've always heard this, by the way, but that young people don't want to bring kids into the world for all of these complicated reasons, some of them abstract, some of them related to things like climate change. That seems to be a big one. What do you make of that just sort of general concept? Does that seem more myth than reality?
There is some research showing that what we call fertility morale matters, that views about the future and pessimism about the future can matter. There's a famous study showing that immediately after the dominant political party in an area loses a very close election, that fertility falls in that area, which suggests people downgrade their expectations about the future. However, objective surveys that ask women, you know, why haven't you had kids? Why do you expect to have kids soon? If so, if not, why not? Typically, it's a very small share who will say the reason why not is climate change.
Yeah.
Or the reason why not is the wrong party is in power. There are a few, but it's a small reason. Now, it does exist as a reason. And I can talk in much greater length about the climate change point specifically, but there is a kind of deeper nihilism actually about not just the climate change argument, but some people saying, you know, I just don't want the future looks too bad. It looks too hard. It looks like there's too much suffering in it to bring a child into it. And I say, is it so much worse than 500 years ago or 1,000 years ago when your ancestors, in much greater difficulty, in much harder circumstances, brought your line into the world? Do you think there was so that your life was so unworthy of preservation and continuation that all of that ancient effort was unworthy? Do you really believe that the situation 50 years from now will be so bad that life is not worth living? And as a kind of optimist in a sense, but also philosophically as a Christian humanist, I just reject this. It's a valid point of view in a certain sense that people may just have a negative outlook for the future, but we, as the poem says, we must rage against the dying of the light. You don't just accept that the future must be bad, and so we shouldn't bring people into it.
Again, we'll dig into these particulars here in a moment. Just another broad question. What about this idea that I hear that more educated, more affluent, more progressive people are choosing not to have children, and that at some point you're going to have a national population of vastly more uneducated, deeply conservative people. What do you make it to that idea? I've been hearing that a lot lately.
I don't really think there's very much to it. The differences in fertility rates across political views are not extremely large. They do exist. Conservatives tend to have somewhat more kids, but they're not extremely large. And it's the interesting to note is that when you look at longitudinal studies that follow the same person over the course of their life, one of the reasons why it looks like conservatives have more kids in cross-sectional data is because once you have kids, you get more conservative. And I'm not saying that speculatively. I'm saying that if you look at longitudinal studies at people's political beliefs and how they develop before and after having children, people get more conservative when they have kids. So if you take a cross-sectional data, you say, well, gosh, look, it's only conservatives having kids. You say, no, they were progressive when they had kids. They just became conservative afterwards. The reality is that this has always been true. People more invested in traditional forms of community have always had more kids. And yet, has our society become progressively more traditional and conservative? No, it hasn't. That's not how these things work.
You wrote recently in The Atlantic about what you think is what you describe as a less observed consequence of this low fertility trend, and that is what you describe as a decline in motherhood. And I wanted to ask you a bit about that. One of the things you say is that the characteristics of mothers are changing. They're older, for example. Say a little bit about that, because you say childbearing among women under 20 is really falling. Childbearing among women 35 and older, that's in fact going up.
So it was going up until the last year or two when it's been declining. But on the whole, yes, childbearing is moving later in life. And there's pros and cons to that. On the one hand, that means people more likely to be married, more likely to have a stable financial situation. And birth complications are generally least common among women in their sort of late 20s, early 30s type of period of life. So that's all good. On the other hand, delaying motherhood later in life is the proximate cause of the shortfall in childbearing versus expectations. That is, if you don't start until you're 35, it is difficult to have the number of children that may have been desired, that may have been sort of that life that a given person held in their head as their ambition. So, and then of course you also late in life you get the we notice that when people get towards retirement, their beliefs about ideal fertility tend to tick up a bit. So retirees think people should have more kids, and it's not because their generation always thought people should have more kids. Yeah. It's because being old makes you want grandbabies. Right. And we tend to write that off as like, oh, it's just people wanting grandchildren. But no, it's people wanting grandchildren. It's the fact that it is predictable that when you get old, you will want to be surrounded by the joyous moments of new life, of seeing a child's first step, of holding a baby, of attending weddings and school graduations and violin concerts and these things. This is one of the great joys of life. And so while I don't expect reproductive age women to be ruled by the opinions of 75-year-olds who regret not having more kids, right, I think that society on the whole should keep in mind that it is predictable that most of us regret not having more kids, and most of us, or not most, a plurality regret this, and that shifting fertility later in life does mean less time with your grandchildren, and it means far lower odds of great grandchildren.
Let's talk about why fertility, from your perspective, and these low fertility is, and why this is important, and what's wrong with a lower fertility. And you go through a number of different things in your writing. I wanted to sort of tease out some of these. One of the things you say about that's problematic with low fertility is that low population growth societies, you write, are more easily entrenched. Talk a little bit about that, because it seems like this idea of fairness and equity comes into play, and it's part of your concern here.
Yeah, the main thing is that lower population growth does mean lower economic growth. And there's a lot of reasons why that may be, but a simple one is if there's fewer babies, there's fewer people buying baby stuff, there's fewer need for new houses. Eventually, you know, if population begins to decline, well, there won't be any need for new houses. We'll just be repairing old ones. So the construction industry will face serious headwinds. And, you know, with fewer and fewer population, if you know that your city is going to shrink over the next 30 or 40 years, is housing even really an investment anymore? Because it'll have a constantly declining demand for it. And that starts to spread to every commodity. And so the result is that you get this constant headwind where everyone knows the economy will be smaller in 30 years. What long-term investment will really pay off in that situation? The answer is not many. And as a result of that, you get a situation where the businesses that do best are those that had the most assets at the beginning. So a big, big conglomerate can find ways to preserve itself through a 30-year period of decline. The person who can't is the small startup business that thought they really had a big future ahead of them, and then secular demographic headwinds hit and they never grew. So you get a situation where the biggest companies, the entrenched powers, and this is also a social and cultural factor, the sort of entrenched elite is never threatened to come out of their trench. No one can ever get a new share of the market. No one ever can get that first beachhead in the market because the market's not growing. There's no new customers. Everyone already has their brand loyalty, so to speak.
So fewer disruptors if we have lower fertility rates. And wealth just consolidates. The old guard, the old school just stays there because no one's replacing them or challenging them, is, I guess.
Well, and this is sort of a mathematical necessity too. I mean, if you think about a low fertility situation, that means the number of names that are out there to be listed in wills is smaller than the dying generation. And so quite literally, wealth must concentrate. You can get into an argument about, okay, who's it going to concentrate on? But the point is that you will get, almost as mathematical necessity, greater concentration of wealth.
Here's something you wrote. You said a low population growth environment means that we miss out on the potential Mozarts and Washingtons and Edisons. Mm-hmm. What do you mean?
I mean that human potential is a worthy thing in its own right. The wealth of nations is not the gold reserves of the state treasury. It's not even GDP per capita, as sort of Adam Smith kind of implied. It's human creativity. It's the quality of life that we live, and it is seeing human flourishing, what Aristotle called eudaimonia. And I think that sometimes people say, well, do we really need more people in the world? Yes. Human life is worthy. It is a good thing to live. And human creativity is not predictable. You can't just look at a fetus, or you can't just look at the hypothetical child you might have in your mind and know, is that child an axe murderer or the inventor of the cure for cancer? You can't know that. And I believe that on the whole, the marginal human being isn't awful. The marginal human being is more likely to be Mozart than murderer. And I know that, again, I know that there are folks who will just look and say, well, have you looked at humanity recently? And I would say, yes, I have. And we've done awful things. And yet we have to confess against the darkness in our species that human life is worth it.
So as you ruminate on why it is that fertility rates are going down, I mean, we could talk about a lot of the kind of practical things. Well-educated people are delaying marriage. That's a circumstance. There's a wider use of contraception. There's better sex education. People are distracted by social media, jaded by pornography. I mean, all of these kind of practical things. But I'm wondering, how much of the reason do you think is related to traditional values or cultural norms being undermined? Because this is something you write about and you seem really concerned about.
Yeah, I do care a lot about the extent to which there's a cultural component. And so the first thing I would say is I would remember that the number of kids that people say they want is stable or rising. So whatever the change in culture may be, if there is one, it isn't that people have decided that they hate kids.
Yeah.
Right? People want kids. Yeah. They want more kids. So then what is the change? And I think if you look at the survey research, we do see that people place a lower priority on marriage in general. That is, the share of people who say that it is essential to be married or that they could not be happy without marriage or something like this is declining. And what people want out of marriage, and I know Stephanie Kuntz will talk far more eloquently about this than I can, that what people expect of marriage is changing. And that this is part of a larger cultural process that does have objective outputs. And so when what you want out of marriage is primarily a co-leisure experiencer, so a person who you talk to, do fun things with, go on vacation with, then leisure becomes not just your priority, but a defining priority for your relationship. And so we see that one of the more common reasons that people state for not having kids is that it would interfere with their leisure time. Whereas, sort of your traditional marriage was not primarily about co-leisure. It was often about co-work. And work often meant household because the vast majority of the population was not involved in market production as an employee, but generally agriculture. And so now, of course, the idyllic picture we have of marriage in the past is wrong as well. There were There was a lot of dissatisfaction there as well, for good reasons. But I do wonder if our society has so elevated leisure as a good, that, well, I would note that it's not leading to higher life satisfaction across our society. People are not, in fact, happier than they used to be, than they were 10, 20 years ago. And when I say used to be, I'm not longing for 1915 or something. Yeah. I'd like to get back to the fertility rates of 2007, which was not an apocalyptic time.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it was actually about to be economically, but but we're not talking about like the end of equality or something, right? We're talking about just maybe we overdid it a bit in the last decade or two. Maybe we should consider that the sort of durable logic of multigenerationalism and of investing in a thing larger than yourself, and in prioritizing something over that very nice vacation to Tuscany, maybe this is a good thing.
Are you saying to couples considering having kids that they kind of need to suck it up, you know, develop grit? Because it seems like that's one of the themes. Mm. And maybe it's not that you're saying they're selfish, but their expectations for their lives are either unrealistic or very different.
I think there is – I do not think the main problem is selfishness. And sometimes millennials are characterized this way, that, oh, they're selfish and they just want to go on vacation. But when I say leisure, I don't even think it's necessarily millennials promoting this. This is a cultural norm that we've built from at least from the post-war generation on. The American vacation is not a millennial invention. So yeah. You certainly have to locate this much farther back than my generation. But there is selfishness going on, but I would say it's often not the parent, it's the grandparent or the cousin or the aunt. And what I mean is telling a young couple that's dealing with student loans and can't afford a house because zoning is crazy expensive and all these things, telling them to suck it up and have a kid, first of all, doesn't work. Second of all, is wildly judgmental. Yeah. And third of all, to repeat, doesn't work. But what we can say is that, you know, the way that immigrant communities have higher fertility in the U.S., the way that Americans had higher fertility in the past is that they resided in family groups. So you shared parenting. Yeah. We didn't expect two people to be the sole masters of the lives of these small people who are incredibly hard to train up in the way that they should go. So we did this together. Now, not perfectly, you know, there's, of course, a tendency towards nostalgia, but it is true that multi-generational living among native-born Americans is generally in decline. So... one thing I'm passionate about is just if you believe that it would be good for people to have kids, you should be volunteering to babysit kids. The cultural change we need is not more lectures for millennials. It is society deciding that we all care about this, that we want to invest in this, that it is as important to us to have a minivan parking spot as a handicap parking spot. That it is as important to us to carve out one night a week to babysit the neighbor kids for free so that parents can go get something done or have a date, as to have one night carved out for our, you know, well, my wife and I are addicted to the Supergirl and Arrowverse shows. So, you know, that these things are as important, that caring for our neighbor in this way is as important. And that is not just about millennials. This is every generation needs to do this because Americans, we've bought the idea that the nuclear family is the family, and it's not.
Hmm. It's interesting you talk about some of the things you suggest, and some of the more creative ideas you sort of referred to one there. Adjust rent control to family size, allow larger families to cut in line. As you said, give minivans parking preferences. And this is sort of what you refer to as those who look askance at these larger families as kind of societal free riders. it seems like that this is an important theme for you, this idea of encouraging and not looking down at large families. Mm-hmm. Do you have a sense that we're that there's an elite class in American society that thinks that way?
You know, I hate to talk about elites because it's hard to know what we're talking about.
True.
But I certainly think that you don't find a lot of great, let's say, family models on TV with five kids. You know, you'll find a few. There's always an exception. You're like, well, there's one TV show where such and such thing. And that used to be pretty normal. I mean, hey, Brady Bunch was a show. Of course, at the time that Brady Bunch was airing, in fact, fertility was much lower. But that's neither here nor there. You know, certainly there aren't a lot of role models, but, you know, sit down and talk to somebody that has a large family. You know, the things people feel licensed to say to people who have more than two or three kids, it's absurd. You know, people will unpromptedly sometimes say to, you know, parents of with a lot of kids, you know, you're destroying the environment. You're damaging the world in some sense. You know, why did you do this? Was two not enough? Did you just not love your first two kids enough? You know, I prefer to give all my love to one child that I just love so much. And I'm sorry, that's not quite how love works for one thing, but for another, it's none of your business. Hmm. If somebody wants to have four kids, they can have four kids. The truth is, in terms of the overall sort of moral balance of society, the folks having kids are ensuring that there will be civilization in the future. Okay, if there's no people, there's no society, there's nothing. It is oblivion. So the folks having kids, they're the ones actually perpetuating human life and society and civilization. And so I think that society perhaps is interested in this. If there aren't people in the future, then it's not just Social Security that will be bankrupt. Every company will be bankrupt, and none of your retirement investments will pan out. So yeah, I do regard it as a kind of free riding when somebody not only, if they don't want to have kids, that's fine. I'm not going to force anybody to have kids. But if they then turn around and look down on people who have big families, or if they act like it's some horrible thing to be asked to pay taxes for public schools, or if they act like perhaps babysitting a neighbor kid for one night every 6 months is some fiendish burden akin to conscription, get over it. You are benefiting from the existence of these people. Your life depends on these people existing. The least you can do is change a diaper.
Let me ask you this, finally, Lyman Stone. You say the question really is, how low are we going to go? Because you mentioned that there are some countries that they sort of hit what seemed to be a bottom, and then they're bouncing back. But what are the trends in the United States? Are we bouncing anywhere? Mm-hmm. How low will we get in terms of fertility, as far as you're seeing it right now?
That is the big question. So you can look at a country like Sweden, which is a really interesting case, and their fertility fell very low to like 1.5 children per woman. Right now in the U.S., we're at about 1.7, which is quite low. If it's below 2, that means without immigration, population will tend to decline. So right now we're at about 1.7. Sweden fell to about 1.5, and then they rocketed back up to about 2.1. And then they fell again to about 1.6 and bounced back up to 2. Now they're declining again. Some of these countries, it's like a sine wave or something bouncing up and down, and you have no idea what's going on in their fertility. Other countries, you can look at a lot of the Latin American countries, a lot of the East Asian countries, some of the post-Soviet countries where fertility fell, and then it just sort of like stays there. It just sort of sits at, I mean, for some of the East Asian countries, as low as, 1.2, 1.3 children per woman. I mean, in the U.S., in Puerto Rico, it's already, I think, 1.4 children per woman. It's incredibly low. So the question is, what are we going to do? Are we going to be sort of this maybe Northern European model where, yeah, maybe long run fertility is kind of low, but it bounces around and in the long run, maybe it's okay? Or are we going to be more like Latin America or Asia? And I think we're going to be more like Latin America and Asia. Our fertility is going to fall, and it's going to sit there. And I think that for many reasons. But one reason I think that is because What are the fastest growing demographic groups in the United States? Latin Americans and Asians. And that's great. Wonderful. I'm very pro-immigration. I want folks to move here. I want to have a lot of Americans. But the reality we have to face is that fertility norms are very hard to shake. People bring them with them when they immigrate. And so as our country becomes more influenced by Asian and Latin American fertility norms, we can expect our fertility to fall off to low levels and sit there. And in both regions, the reason for low fertility is delayed marriage and high stigmas on unmarried childbirth. Whereas in the Northern European countries, unmarried childbirth is not stigmatized nearly as much. In the U.S., marriage is being very delayed. And if we're being honest, we have a lot of stigma on unmarried childbirth. So I think we are going to have low fertility and it's going to stick for a long time.
Lyman Stone, he's a regional population economics researcher, and you can read about his research on his blog. It's called In a State of Migration. There's a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. I'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West from KUER.
KUER teams up with local and national businesses around the state to support the station and bring you Utah stories and national news from NPR. If you've got a business, like a restaurant or a car repair shop, or maybe you take wedding photos or offer legal services, whatever it is, when you join KUER as a business sponsor, you're helping people who care deeply about facts and storytelling stay connected to their community, all while building your company's brand. Learn more about becoming a sponsor at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about why it is the American birth rate is tanking. Our next guest on the program is Stephanie Kuntz, who teaches history and family studies at the Evergreen State College. She also serves as director of public education at the Council on Contemporary Families. She's the author of a number of books, among them Marriage, A History, and The Way We Never Were. She joined us from her office in Olympia, Washington. To the question about fertility in general, a lot of what we talked about with Lyman Stone was how people, in fact, still want kids, but that circumstances have changed and that there are complicated reasons for all of that. Do you at least agree with that point for Lyman Stone?
I do agree. And in fact, last year, polls showed that the gap between the number of women and the number of children women said they wanted to have and the number that they expected to have reached its highest point in 40 years. But I think we also have to recognize that people want different things from their children and for their children in the past. When you go back 500 years ago to the high fertility rates then, one of the reasons they had high fertility rates was because people needed child labor. They had kids so that they could help support themselves. There were also higher mortality rates, and they were afraid that they might not have anyone to support them in their old age or to work for wages in the family economy if they didn't have kids. Well, as we progressed, as education became extended, kids became more expensive commodities, and they became less of an immediate practical material resource than an important emotional resource. That led to huge improvements in the treatment of children, but it also led to fertility restriction, you know, a decline in fertility. People didn't feel that they should have or could have as many children. Now, when we get to the period we're in now, I think we have to accept the fact that fertility is never going to go back to as high as it was 100 years ago or 200 years ago. But there are things we can do that make it easier for women and men to have as many children as they'd like to have. And those aren't being done right now.
Yeah. I want to get to the particulars of that. To the general question, how do you react when you hear Lyman Stone and others talk about cultural values and traditional family values? As someone who wrote a book, the title of which is The Way We Never Were, does that send up red flags that our expectations about how culture plays out in this is unrealistic or not at all true?
Well, yes, I think that there is a tendency on many people's parts to romanticize the values of the past, to cherry pick the ones that sound good in the abstract and ignore the tremendous violations of those in practice. And the flip side of that, of course, and this is a place Lyman and I think would agree, is the tendency to denigrate the values of the present. You know, all these ideas that millennials are somehow more selfish than people of the past. He talked about the fact that maybe they were a little selfish because one of the reasons that people give for not having children is that they want more leisure time. But that's actually way down on the list. And of the 8 reasons that people give, 6 of them have to do with financial insecurity. And the top non-financial one is that they want to spend more time with their kids, helping their kids out. So I don't think that we are in a cultural crisis of not valuing children, except I think we may be, and we can get into this later, into a political and economic crisis of not helping people have the kind of children that they need and that our society needs.
You say that younger people are taking longer to rush into their responsibilities, but that's a good thing, and that their marriages are less likely to end in divorce, and that they're more attentive as parents. So it seems like there are a lot of really, even though they're delaying marriage and therefore delaying having kids and then having less kids, that it seems like, is there an argument to be made that they might be better parents and better spouses?
Oh, there's not only an argument to be made, there's a lot of evidence supporting that. The longer a woman delays marriage right up through her 30s, there's one little dip at about 35 to 37, and then it keeps going, her chance of divorce falls with every year that she delays marriage, except for a little blip in 35 to 37, and then it starts falling again. We found that there's been a tremendous reversal in the outcome of kids. When we looked at kids born to mothers over 35 back in the 80s and 90s, those kids were not doing well. Now they're doing great. And so there's lots to be said for delaying. Lyman's right that if you delay children to 35, you're more likely to run into the 40 to 44-year-old period where your fertility declines. But it's interesting. Lyman pointed out that all age groups have been declining in fertility. That's not true. The age groups 40 to 44 have actually been rising. And although the fertility rate per 1,000 women is lower today than it was in 1990, the completed fertility rate is actually higher. So as we get more chances for people to have safe babies at an older age, I think that we may find an uptick again.
I do want to ask you about another thing that came up with Lyman, and that was the question of whether or not young people are feeling a kind of, you know, malaise or pessimism about the future. And in the not so abstract question of climate change, for example, that's something that is worrying them, and that they feel like having more kids than they should is going to be an environmental problem. How much of that do we need to take into account when we think about this story?
Well, we actually have a poll that was just published last week by the New York Times, where they asked people why are they having fewer babies. And 33%, a full third, said that they were concerned about environmental degradation and climate change. And I've talked to people when I go around making speeches on these family issues, where kids are really worried about competition for resources as seas flood and stuff like that. So I certainly agree that people are worried about the future and worried about the lack of foresight for the future that so many of our political and corporate leaders show. On the other hand, I think the most immediate problem is the financial problem. And you look at millennials saddled with college debts, looking at the rising cost of education in America, the uneven quality, the inequality of the things that they want to have for their children, financial insecurity, much more job and income volatility than in the past. And yes, they may be a little nervous. And in fact, there's interesting research that shows that, you know, Lyman said, how come they're not having babies? Because the economy is expanding. Well, we might want to think of them as the canary in the coal mine, because there's new evidence that's really surprising that fertility rates tend to fall in the few months just before we begin to get a decline in economic indicators. So there's something going on as people start to plan for their future that they pick up on signals that the economists are missing.
That's interesting. I also want to ask you, you say that highly educated women are having more kids than in the past. But one of the things you also take note of is that if you want women, like Limestone does, if you want women to have more kids, you have to make it easier to combine work and having kids. Talk a little bit about this, because it seems like this is something you're seeing in Europe, where there's this uptick in the fertility rates because you talk about how social and corporate policies are just making it easier for women, and it seems like they're including men more in the equation.
Yes, and I completely agree with Lyman that people who don't have kids are in a sense free riders. I don't mean it in a selfish way, because actually single childless individuals spend more time helping aging relatives and doing work, taking care of coworkers than married kids. Married people with children. But it's absolutely true that we need these children and we should support them. And I don't think asking people to babysit for free, although there are plenty of single childless women who do that and men too, I don't think that's really the answer. The answer is to make it possible for people to combine work and family. And there's two very interesting things that seem to increase fertility. One is that women now want to work. They feel a need to work. It used to be that if you denied women the right to a job, they stayed home and have babies. Today, if you make it impossible for them to combine having babies and having a job, they tend to not have babies. We've had the fertility upticks. Childcare is a really important predictor, family leave for making it easier for women. The other thing, and this is where you're quite right, that paternity comes into it. Because we have new values about marriage and child rearing that suggest that women shouldn't specialize in this and men in breadwinning, that it's better and we're happier and the kids are better off. And by the way, couples have more sex when they actually combine breadwinning and childcare and share it more equally. They report themselves happier. So it's very important then to get the men involved, not just to make it easier for the women to combine work and family, but for the men to combine work and family. And that's where things like paternity leave come in. And we have several studies from Europe that show that a woman is much more likely to have a second child if the father was available to help out with the first child and did so.
So it's unrealistic. This expectation, this somehow, and I'm not sure how much of this exists, but it seems like there was this idea, this traditional family idea, this expectation that women are going to leave the workforce and go home exclusively. You see, that's just an unrealistic expectation. That doesn't seem like that's going to happen.
It's not going to happen for a lot of reasons, partly because of the economy, that you need two earners in most countries nowadays, but partly because women have found meaning in work. It gives them a sense of independence, a sort of meaning. It makes their marriages better because it gives them more clout in the marriage, more decision-making. It makes it possible for them to leave a bad or abusive marriage. It makes it possible for them to have a child out of wedlock if they haven't found a man and they really want to devote themselves to parenting. So for all these reasons, work has become very important to women, and they're not about to abandon it. We know that one of the reasons that the Asian and Latin American countries, some of those have their fertility rates have declined, is because it is so hard for women to combine work and family. And at this point, if you tell them they can't, that may work in the opposite direction of what defenders of the so-called traditional family would like it to do.
Talk a little bit, if you would, Professor, about some of the economic considerations that couples are going through when they think about having kids. College debt is one that you've talked about, rising housing prices. So economic factors are big here, it seems.
They are very big. And, again, You know, maybe people weren't so good, well off 500 years ago, but that's not what people compare themselves to when they make decisions about the future and assess, you know, how well their life is going to go. You make decisions about what your grandparents and your parents did. And we've had a very bad situation for that for the last 30 years. You go back to 1947 to almost 1970, the period of the baby boom. What was happening there? You had an expanding economy, and every generation of young men aged 25 to 30 was making three times as much, in a couple of years, four times as much in constant dollars as their fathers had made at the same age. Since 1980, that's changed. And for the past 25 years, they've been making less than their fathers did at the same age. Now, when people look at that and particularly compare, well, okay, yes, I can buy more computers, I can buy fancier TVs, but the cost of educating people to get decent jobs that have benefits is just rising way faster than inflation. Young people are, I think, saying to themselves realistically, can I afford this? And even though I want these kids. So I think that kind of economic problem is very, very real, and we have to find some way of dealing with that.
What do you think we do about that? I mean, some of the things that Lyman Stone writes about is removing, you know, fiscal penalties for marriage, expanding tax credits for children. He even talked about some of his more kind of novel ideas, like making giving parking privileges to minivans and things like that. I mean, what are some of the practical things that you're thinking about for all of this?
Well, I think that we have to work on two fronts. I mean, I admit that you're going to have face some serious economic challenges if you continue to build your economy on the basis that the way forward is constant expansion of the marketplace. Mm-hmm. That if we don't get constantly increasing population and increasing demand, that we're in trouble. I think that we should think creatively about alternatives to that, to how to use robots usefully rather than to replace existing workers, but to replace non-existing workers. And how maybe if he says that the inheritance taxes are a problem or the inheritances are going to increase inequality, maybe going back to that age-old American principle, actually, that most people don't know about, that allowing people to inherit too much wealth is, in fact, a form of a real threat to democracy. But I think more concretely, the things that we can do have to do with providing a social network of support for those families, whether you have kids or not. Here's where Lyman and I completely agree. They should be a treasured aspect of our future. They are the ones who will produce great art, who will contribute to the Social Security, who will take care of us when we're old. And we as a society should be making it possible for young people to think about having kids so that they've got affordable quality childcare. They don't have to worry all the time about how their kids are being cared for, that we can reduce the work week, go back to, for example, the 1950s and 60s when the work week was actually shorter than it is today and the vacations were longer. We can do all sorts of things to make it more possible to combine work and family for both men and women, and that's going to be good for everyone, I think.
Let me ask you finally, how do you think our ideas of quote-unquote family, how are they changing now? How are young people thinking about the idea of family when fewer are wanting a piece of paper, a certificate of marriage, and still they want to be together? You now have the introduction of same-sex couples, non-traditional kinds of relationships in some cases. How is family changing, if it is at all? Part of me thinks that in some ways it's not changing all that much, at least our concept of wanting to be with someone and to love someone and to care for children and our parents. It seems like in some ways it isn't changing all that much.
Well, I agree with you. I mean, there are some troublesome things, the social media and its effect on young kids and teenagers, I think may be a problem down the road if it's not already. But in general, the main change has been that our expectations of family life are higher than they have been in the past. And for most people, that means that people try harder to live up to them. It does mean that when family doesn't live up to them, people don't feel compelled to stay in a marriage, for example, or to continue a relationship with a parent who's been abusive. And that can, you know, that can have its problems. On the other hand, it reflects a much greater sense that intimacy, fairness, democracy, affection, and obligation are an important part of what makes a family, and it's not just biology or blood, which is why people have begun to be much more accepting of same-sex marriage, of adoption, of all sorts of arrangements, if they are based upon commitment.
That's Stephanie Kuntz. She teaches history and family studies at the Evergreen State College, is the author of a number of books on American families, marriage, and gender relationships. Among them, the book, The Way We Never Were. She joined us from her office in Olympia, Washington. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction from Tim Slover. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.